Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
All right, welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Scott.
Hey, Kevin, why don't you tell us what's on the OR schedule for today?
We're really excited to have Dr. Stanley Goldberg, colorectal surgeon and professor of surgery at the University of Minnesota. Today, he's going to talk to us about rectal prolapse and benign anorectal disease.
Yeah, we're also very happy to give our random fact of the day about the history of reality TV shows.
Well, can't wait for that. But before that, let's get started with our opening shot.
Today, we're going to focus on everybody's favorite topic. That's rectal prolapse. So in order to understand rectal prolapse, we have to pin down a few definitions. Kevin, tell me the difference between rectal prolapse, full thickness rectal prolapse, rectal intussusception, and then hemorrhoids.
So rectal prolapse is when the rectum in all of its layers is protruded through the anus.
Yep. So real easy. Rectal prolapse, full thickness of the rectum, boom, through the anus.
The intussusception, which is sometimes confused for rectal prolapse, is when the rectum telescopes on itself but does not protrude from the anus.
Yeah, classically a diagnosis of patients who have obstructed defecation. They get a defecography, and you can see that rectum intussuscepting or telescoping on itself, but it doesn't come through the anal verge. And then hemorrhoids?
Hemorrhoids, you'll see, prolapse and hemorrhoids, you'll see the three columns that'll indicate that that's what you're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, the mucosal prolapse or the hemorrhoids, this is a weakness of the attachments between the submucosa and the muscularis propria of the distal rectum, and you get prolapsing of the mucosa itself. Procedentia, or rectal prolapse, is full thickness rectal prolapse through the wall. And so, you know, interestingly, it's been associated with a couple of different predisposing factors. So, Jay, what are some of the predisposing factors to those patients who have full thickness rectal prolapse?
Yeah, there is an association with rectal intussusception. Patients who have a deep cul-de-sac, who have loss of the rectal fixation, levator ani diastasis, who have a floppy redundant sigmoid. It's been associated with pudendal neuropathy, a patulous anal sphincter. Gender, it's very rare in males, but it's quite common in females, particularly females who've had many children.
Yeah, and so again, one of the controversies out there is if you have a patient who has intussusception, will they go on? Is it a continuum where they will go on to have a full thickness rectal prolapse? And there's some debate about that. Generally, most people say no. The mere fact that you have a physical structure that's going through the anus, not too surprising that you have a pudendal neuropathy, that you have a patulous anal sphincter in those patients. And Kevin, so a patient comes to me and they have question of something's coming out their bottom. What is some history that you want to take with that patient?
Right. So you want to confirm that they have a protruding mass with straining and if this reduces on its by itself or not.
And just to clarify right there, again, that mass, we're making sure this isn't a cancer or anything like that, but this mass is what the patients will tell it. They'll come to you and they'll say, hey, listen, I got this thing that's kind of hanging out my bum, or my bum's hanging out.
Right. And a lot of times they'll complain of some pelvic pressure or tenesmus, and they'll also have some incomplete evacuation. And they can also have issues with rectal bleeding and mucosal discharge.
So probably functionally, and why I think it's important at this stage, is to take this history of constipation and incontinence. And what you'll see is a wide range of each of those. And in some patients, they may have both. So constipation's been reported anywhere between 25 and 75%. And essentially, incontinence is a little bit higher, anywhere from 50 to 75%. And the reason that that's important is I will tell all my patients is, hey, I can fix your rectal prolapse, but you may or may not notice any change in your functional results. I can fix the anatomical portion, but in many cases, because that's been hanging through the anus for so long and you do have that patchless anal sphincter, you do have that neuropathy that potentially they may not get much better. So, Jay, the patient comes to you, you take this history, and now it's time for your physical exam. What do you look for in physical exam?
Well, you need to have them prolapse out the rectum. So the first thing you have to do is you have them strain on a toilet and actually push it out. And you'll see that unmistakable mass of the circular concentric mucosal folds. They'll often have a patulous anus, and it's frequently associated with uterine prolapse or cystocele.
Yeah, and I think that last point, so a couple of points, that last point was a very good one. So when you think about rectal prolapse, a lot of people will call it the tetralogy of fallout, that you'll have a lot of different things. They can have anterior problems. They can have a associated rectocele, a cystocele. They can have, you know, bladder and vaginal introitus type problems. And so all of these different ones are things that may need to be addressed along the way. The other point is that you made it very subtle to it, is to have them strain on the toilet if that's available. If not, and if you don't have a toilet readily available, to have the patient stand up and squat down, put a towel down, do whatever you have to do, and then have them squat and go from there. Because in a prone jackknife position or even in a left lateral position, you may not be able to get that prolapse to be able to come out. And so, and in many cases, and not many cases, but in some cases, you even have to give them an enema to be able to stimulate it to be able to come out. So, Kevin, you know, this is a clinical diagnosis. Let's face it. You don't necessarily need to have a large degree of workup to be able to say that a patient's got rectal prolapse. But what other adjunctive testing can you have available for these patients?
Well, the most important thing is you want to make sure you don't have a tumor. So you have to do a rigid proctosigmoidoscopy. And you also want to see if there's any rectal ulcers associated with this.
Yeah. So again, for those patients who come to you, you want to make sure that their screening is up to date. If they haven't had a colonoscopy, you do a colonoscopy. If they're there in clinic, you want to make sure that they're, if you got a, you know, procto that you can perform and make sure that this isn't a tumor. In many cases, you're looking for a solitary rectal ulcer because these patients do have obstructive defecation. And in that kind of that process of having that ulcer right there may be a concomitant evaluation. And there's some places out there that talk about anorectal physiology testing to be able to get manometry or pudendal nerve latency testing, defecography, or even a transit time. But again, that's something that's kind of going over and above, and there's it may or may not affect your management. Okay, very brief, very quick. Jay, couple of different ways to approach this. We can approach it perineally. We can approach it abdominally. We can approach it abdominally. We can approach it open, or we can do minimally invasive. Let's focus first on perineal operations. There's over 100 different operations out there, but basically there's two big ones. And what are those two big ones?
Well, the two main perineal approaches are the Altmaier and the Delorme.
Yeah, so the Delorme operation is basically what we're doing on the Delorme operation is we're going to take that mucosa in the submucosa. We're going to resect that, and that's going to leave us with that muscle. And we're going to take those big bites and perform a plication. And then after we've resected that one, that'll leave us our mucosa, and we'll bring that all the way down. Kevin, the difference between that Delorme operation and an Altmaier or a perineal rectal sigmoidectomy, can you tell us the difference there?
Well, the Altmaier, you're prolapsing the rectum, and you're doing a full thickness excision of the rectum, and then you're putting it back together.
Yeah. So again, that, you know, like in a peds operation where you're taking that full thing out there, this, what we're trying to do in this one is Dr. Altmaier, I believe he was from Cincinnati, basically took this down and you're doing a full thickness excision of that redundant prolapse and then doing a hand sewn or a, I guess some people may do a stapled anastomosis, doing essentially a coloanal anastomosis. Jay, couple of different, many different abdominal operations, but they really do go into a few categories. What are those?
Well, you have rectopexy alone, and there's different techniques to doing this. There's a suture rectopexy, Wells procedure, Ripstein procedure. You have resection where you just resect the redundant sigmoid, and then you have resection with rectopexy, and these can be done open or laparoscopic.
Yeah, and just to clarify, the resection alone was more of a historical one where they used to actually do LARs for these particular ones. The resection rectopexy is exactly what you said, the classic Frickman-Goldberg procedure, and we're lucky enough to talk to Dr. Goldberg today on this operation, and we'll find out the history behind that operation. But essentially, we're adding a sigmoid resection more for those patients who are constipated in that particular one. So, Kevin, tell me very briefly about the advantages and the disadvantages between the perineal approach.
Right. So the perineal approach, you're generally going to use this in your old sick patients. You can use regional or general anesthesia, have a very short hospital stay, low morbidity, low mortality, not as much pain associated with this, and it can also help with their incontinence.
Yeah, well, help with their incontinence in the fact that if you're doing a perineal approach and they have a concomitant sphincter defect, that potentially you could do a sphincteroplasty at this particular time. Honestly, not done as much. I'm not going to tell you that, but that is a theoretical advantage. What about the disadvantages to the perineal approach?
And there are some real disadvantages, and this is why you generally use these in your elderly patients, but you'll have a higher recurrence rate. You lose the capacitance and the function of the rectum sometimes with this.
Well, if you're taking the rectum out, you're for sure going to lose the capacitance of that rectum. What else?
Some patients complain of urgency and incontinence after this and cannot treat any of the other intra-abdominal pathology if it existed.
So in general, Kevin, who are the perineal approaches best left for?
So these are your poor risk patients, maybe someone that came in with an incarcerated or strangulated prolapse.
Yeah, that's a great point. So even if you have a healthy young patient, they come in with an incarcerated or strangulated prolapse, probably the best operation for those is through a perineal approach. Who else?
And like we discussed, patients with incontinence or sphincter defects that you can repair concomitant sphincters at the same time. If it's a small prolapse, you can consider the perineal approach, and then young men actually do best with the perineal approach.
Yeah, probably small prolapse, a Delorme may work a little bit better. And the theoretical, the theory behind having young men in this is that abdominal approaches, especially with a mobilization, you put the pelvic nerves at risk that can affect mm-hmm. their sexual function. Although, I think if you do a good operation, that's less of a potential advantage. And so, again, now focusing a little bit more on the operation from above, you have, as he said, there's a couple of different ones. Jason, take us through kind of what is the overall major steps when you talk about the abdominal approaches and the fixation and suspension of them.
Yeah, regardless of which technique you're using, mobilization of the rectum and...
Yeah, you want to make sure that you go all the way down to the coccyx. Now, yeah. I will, if you're doing a posterior mobilization, and the only reason I kind of interrupted right there is mm-hmm. I didn't ask you a very good question, is that we do know that there is some controversy, especially when you talk about emerging more in the United States versus Europe, the ventral versus the posterior. And we're going to focus a little bit today. We have Dr. Goldberg on here about the posterior, but it's getting a mobilization all the way down.
Down to the coccyx.
Yeah, and then the other aspects of this?
You have to fix the rectum into a posterior position. When you do this with a suture rectopexy, you fix the rectum to the sacrum with non-absorbable sutures, or you can wrap the rectum and fix it with fix the wrap to the sacrum itself.
Yeah, and that's a classical Ripstein, is where mm-hmm. you wrap that rectum, fix it posterior, and then you have the Wells.
Where you can partially wrap the rectum and fix it posteriorly.
Yeah, and again, so, just to focus very quickly on mobilization, there's a lot of different people out there probably that perform this operation that have different views. There's people who do a ventral rectopexy that completely leave posteriorly in place, and there's other people that will say that my posterior mobilization, I'm going to take it all the way down to the coccyx, and I'm mm-hmm. going to do very limited laterally, because laterally is where you get the quote unquote the lateral ligaments, mm-hmm. and in general, that if you do a complete circumferential dissection, you include those lateral ligaments, you're going to get a better mobilization. So that better mobilization, you're probably going to get associated with a lower recurrence rate. Versus the downside to that is the fact that with a more of a mobilization, taking those lateral ligaments, your functional results may not be as good. So that's the kind of the controversy that involves in there. So like most things, we can do this either through a minimally invasive approach, Kevin, laparoscopically, robotically. Are the steps any different laparoscopically with an open approach?
No, it's generally the exact same procedure.
Yeah, and if you can suture, maybe some people might use a little bit mesh a little bit more or do whatever, but there's been a meta-analysis that have looked at and showed that there's really no difference in an open or lap by either recurrence or by morbidity. And in general, laparoscopy, not too surprising. Length of stay is a little bit less, maybe a little bit longer operative times, but I think with most operations out there, as we get more skilled and more facile in this, that those operative times are becoming equivalent out there.
I'm a little surprised by that, given that you'd think there'd be more scarring and adhesions when you did it open, that it might fix the rectum better.
Well, I think if you do that mobilization, whether it's a mobilization, because remember, in many cases, these are planes that have never been gone before. So you're doing the mobilization, whether you do it open or whether you do it laparoscopy. If you do the same mobilization and you're bringing it up, you're developing just as much scar tissue where the points where you want it to scar. Remember, you're mobilizing the rectum to pull it up. Your fixation on that particular rectum is focusing on holding it in place till it scars into position. So laparoscopy versus open, the recurrence rate, if you do the same operation, should theoretically be in the same point. Kevin, or Jason, we touched on this earlier talking mm-hmm. about the functional. So I fixed it. I'm telling you, the patient has no recurrence. How much does their incontinence really improve in these patients?
Well, incontinence typically occurs somewhere between roughly 5 to 15%. It's more common after resection than with rectopexy alone.
Yeah, and that's something we don't do, like we talk about a little bit more, mm-hmm. but it definitely you can have it when the perineal root.
And there may be pre-existing things that cause this. So you may just be seeing a correction of the constipation that may make the incontinence more pronounced postoperatively.
Yeah, and that's why in a lot of these patients, you see that the percentage of incontinent patients who are improved by the rectal prolapse surgery is all over the map. You have some patients, in general, they'll get better, but I never tell my patients that their incontinence is going to definitely improve in those. Mm-hmm. Constipation, Kevin, how does the functional results of those patients who have constipation after rectopexy, how does this differ between the various ones?
So it's more common after rectopexy than resection. And then the redundant sigmoid may fold and cause outlet obstruction.
And that's exactly the thought process behind the Frickman-Goldberg procedure, mm-hmm. is that those patients who have a large floppy colon that basically suffer from that constipation, we're going to remove that sigmoid colon and do our rectopexy. And that's really those patients that is indicated in those who suffer from a large degree of constipation that should undergo a resection rectopexy. So recurrent rectal prolapse is something that, these patients are going to have then. And I'll just close with a final couple of thoughts on recurrent rectal prolapse. One is that in our study in Minnesota demonstrated that if a patient's risk profile can permit it, that if you can do an abdominal operation, it's associated with less recurrence over time. It doesn't matter if it's the second time they recur, the third time they recur, the fourth time they recur, whatever it is, that they probably have a better chance of having lower recurrence with an abdominal operation versus a perineal reproach. There's a couple of things, and I think Dr. Goldberg is going to tell us this in his tips and tricks, that you have to be aware of. And that's if you have somebody who's undergone a previous resection, for example, let's say they undergo a resection rectopexy, mm-hmm. and you decide to do a perineal approach, you better make sure you get that staple line all the way out. Or if you leave a staple line and you got a hand sewn anastomosis, yeah. you may have a devascularized segment. So understand what was performed at the previous operation to make sure you don't have a complication associated with the other one, with your next operation that didn't necessarily have to happen. So that's it for our opening shot about rectal prolapse. Again, we're happy to have Dr. Stanley Goldberg from the University of Minnesota join us today as we talk a little bit about not only rectal prolapse, but about the history of colorectal surgery as well as anal fistula disease.
So you know what that sound means? It's time for our random fact of the day. Today's random fact is going to focus a little bit about none other than reality TV, something that we all enjoy. Kevin, I know you watch a lot of that in your spare time.
All about The Bachelor.
So it's interesting, when you go back to the history of reality television, there's quite a bit of debate in terms of what encompasses a true reality TV show. As a matter of fact, there is a fair amount of controversy as to what was the first reality TV show. If you go back to the 1940s and 50s, some people say it was a show that was began in the mid-40s called Queen for a Day, which was an early example of a reality-based television. That was followed up by Alan Funt's Hidden Camera, Candid Camera Show. But really, all these different formats, along with Mutual of Omaha and a lot of the sports or a lot of the game shows, weren't really reality TV as we think about it today. There is one show out there that really is credited in terms of the reality-based television today. What is that, Kevin?
Yeah, so this is interesting. It's a show actually out of the Netherlands called Nummer 28, named for the street that the house was on. And they took seven strangers, all freshmen at the University of Amsterdam, and put them together in a house. And their lives were followed for several months. And they published an episode about once a week that was only 20 minutes long, that had no game shows in it. And it was just literally following them around throughout their day.
Yeah, so many of the things that we take for granted in today's reality TV in terms of soundtrack music, interspersing the events, and those after-the-fact confessionals that everybody likes to see when they go stick their face right in front of the camera, really originated from this. As a matter of fact, Kevin, it originated so much that in 1992, MTV, the longest-running reality series called The Real World, of course, aired based in large part. Eric Latour, the creator of the concept, said that the Real World was directly inspired by Nummer 28.
And Nummer 28, interestingly, only ran for one season before it was cut.
And that has been your Random Fact of the Day.
Welcome to Behind the Knife. We have the absolute pleasure of having one of my mentors join us today, Dr. Stanley Goldberg. Dr. Goldberg is a clinical professor of surgery at the University of Minnesota Medical School, and he's been a past president of the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons, and he has a honorary fellowship in probably the majority of the major institutions from around the world. Dr. Goldberg, thank you so much, sir, for joining us here on Behind the Knife.
It's my pleasure.
So, with almost a half century of experience in colorectal surgery, can you describe a little bit about how the changes that you have seen from general surgery into this whole era of subspecialization, and how colorectal surgery initially maybe was in the public sector and, you know, in the community hospitals, and how that's made a giant transformation?
Well, Scott, first of all, I think we have to start giving credit to some of the people who really initiated all this change. And I'm going to go back in history a little bit, if it's okay with you.
Absolutely.
I really think the person who deserves a lot of credit is Professor Owen H. Wangenstein, and I'll elaborate in a minute. But if you think back 100 years ago, the specialty really was there were a bunch of charlatans running around selling various ointments and suppositories at various county fairs. And so the proctologic proctologic field really had not a very good name. However, there were a group of people, primarily in the Midwest, who what you don't realize is the fact that at the turn of the century, last century, there are basically two major surgical groups, medical groups in the United States. There was the AMA and there was the Southern Medical Association. Now, the Southern Medical Association had a section of, quote, proctology. And so if you wanted to present a paper related to rectal disease, you presented it at the Southern Medical. Mm-hmm. Well, there were a group of doctors from the Midwest who would show up at the Southern Medical, and they shortly and that was held in November. And then they decided to form a little group called the Midwest Society of Proctologists. And what they decided to do was to teach each other their surgical techniques. And so every year in the spring, they would meet in a different town, Minneapolis, Omaha, Kansas City, Detroit, up and down the Mississippi Valley. And they would put on wet clinics. And that's the way education was done in those days in that field. So now we're talking in the 1930s. At this point, people like Dr. Fansler, who resided in Minneapolis, they decided there should be an American Board of Proctology. And in 1934, 3 years before the American Board of Surgery was established, they established the American Board of Proctology.
We beat them to the punch.
Exactly. 3 years before the American Board of Surgery. Well, the American Board of Surgery then set up a special certification in rectal surgery. Then World War II came along, and at the end of World War II, the American Board of Surgery decided there should be only one certifying examination, the American Board of Surgery. And so they took away the examination in rectal surgery, and in 1949, the American Board of Proctology gave its first examination. And actually, there were three people from Minneapolis. Here, I know you want to know why things got going in Minneapolis. There were three people from Minneapolis who took that examination. They had all been preceptors of Dr. Fansler here in Minneapolis. And so they took the exam in 1949. Well, fast forward, when I came on the scene in about finishing medical school in the 50s and starting my surgical residency in general surgery, I rotated onto a rectal service out at the Veterans Hospital here in Minneapolis. And I saw some things that really didn't look very good. And so, make a long story short, I went in to see Dr. Wangenstein to, quote, kind of complain about what was going on. And I'll never forget, the Great White Father got up from his chair, and he went to the door, and he closed the door of the office, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, Stanley, you've got to change things. I'm a first-year resident, and I kind of swallowed. He says, the way they train rectal surgeons in this country is wrong. At that time, all you needed was 1 year of general surgery and 2 years of a preceptorship. He says, all rectal surgeons should be board-certified general surgery, and then they should take extra training. He says, you've got to change it. And I was a first-year resident, and in 5 minutes, that man changed my life. That's basically what went on. And from there, he was the first one at Minnesota who had ever trained at St. Mark's Hospital. And when I got the opportunity in 1962, thanks to Dr. Lillehei, I was able to go to St. Mark's. When I came home from St. Mark's, having studied with Lockhart Mummery, having studied with Naunton Morgan and Alan Parks and Ian Todd, I decided that we got to do things here a little differently in Minnesota. So, but going back in history, actually, our preceptorship started here at the University of Minnesota in 1917. So we had a preceptorship going until Dr. Bernstein, he changed it in 56 to a fellowship. And at that time, there were only five or six fellowships in rectal surgery in the whole United States. So that's when things started to change.
Have you had a feel for how this has impacted, you know, in the politics of academic surgery as it's gone from the community into basically being ubiquitous?
Right. Well, very honestly, there was a lot of pushback from the general surgeon. As a matter of fact, it really took the understanding of somebody like Dr. Wangenstein to allow this to evolve. And along these lines, I also have to give credit to Dr. Najarian. And Dr. Najarian, who took over for Dr. Wangenstein here at the university, he understood specialty surgery. And I'll never forget when he first offered me the job as head of colorectal surgery at Minnesota, he looked me in the eye and he says, should every colon resection be done by a colorectal surgeon? I said, absolutely not. I said, however, I really think there's got to be places or institutions where somebody who wants to get extra experience in colorectal surgery should have the opportunity to train. And so to his credit, he allowed us to really establish things and increase the size of it. Our program here, we used to train one every 2 years. Then we trained, we were able to increase it to two, and then anyhow, we got it up to five. And in the last, we've trained 175 colorectal surgeons all over the world, as you probably know.
You have had so much experience with residents. What would you say has really stood out in terms of the most important factors maybe that you've taught them through the years and maybe some things that kind of stand out of your mind that they have taught you? Can you think of any of that?
Oh, my goodness. I learned so much. I mean, our first pouch operation, we did the first pouch operation here in Minnesota back in the 70s. And literally, I learned that operation from one of our fellows, Dr. Béliveau, who's at the university in Canada, Paul Béliveau. And I remember the night before we did our first pouch operation, I was debating between doing a J pouch and an S pouch. Then I figured, well, as long as Paul Béliveau is here with us now and he had trained with Sir Alan Parks, I figured, let's go with the S pouch. So that's really what determined the fact that we did the S pouch. I mean, when you think about all the things that we have learned, I can remember we did the first stapled anastomosis, intraluminal stapled anastomosis, and that never would have come about without the assistance of John Bowles. John was a brilliant, superb technician, came to us from Australia. And I remember being at the American College of Surgeons. Well, actually, I got to go back one to really make this story good. back in the 60s, I remember I was in Dr. Lillehei's laboratory, and we got a phone call from Dr. Wangenstein that the Russians were coming with their stapling device, and he told us to prepare some dogs. So we prepared some dogs, and the Russians came with this stapling device, and we played with it all afternoon in the dog lab. At the end of the afternoon, we just said it was a piece of junk. We didn't think it was going to add anything. That's in the 60s. So fast forward to the 70s, late 70s, and I'll never forget it. It was a Sunday afternoon, and it was I was at our cottage, and the phone rang, and it was a stockbroker, and gets on the phone, and he says, "Stan," he says, "what do you think about this company that's got a stapling machine?" He says, I said, "I know all about it." I said, "It's a piece of junk." At that time, stock was selling for $1.70 something, and wow. This was the first EEA, and this was August. And 2 months later, I'm at the American College of Surgeons, and John Bowles is with me. And we walk into the American College of Surgeons, and we looked at this display of the first EEA, which was, I couldn't believe the difference of this instrument versus the one we had worked with 15 years before. And John Bowles looks me in the eye, and he says, "Stan," he says, "that's going to change what we do in the pelvis." And with that, I did something I've never done in my life. I took out my checkbook. I wrote a check for $1,000 for the first EEA. And that it arrived here right after Christmas. And we did our first stapled anastomosis January 8th, 1978. And that was it. But when you say, what do you learn from all of your students? I mean, John was tremendous. Dr. Finney, I mean, we are probably number one in the country in terms of TEM and the like, transanal endoscopic microsurgery, all related to Dr. Finney's work in that area. Dr. Wong, who went on to be the head at Sloan Kettering Memorial, he introduced us to endorectal ultrasound. And anyhow, so we learned from our students all the time.
I thought you were going to tell me
that's
that
just
you,
a few of them.
I thought you were going to tell me that you took out your checkbook and you immediately wrote a check for the stapler stock. I thought that's what you're going to do.
Well, matter of fact, you're absolutely right. The stock, Scott. The stock. Let's see. That was in September. And we did our first one in January, and the following June, the stock was $28 instead of a dollar, whatever it was. Wow. That was. I wish I had taken $1,000. Anyhow.
Well, sir, I think next we're going to move into the next segment of our podcast, and that's called the Dissection of the Day. And that's where we delve a little more in detail about a particular surgical topic. And since we have you with us today, we thought we would talk more about perianal fistulas as well as rectal prolapse. So starting simple, when you're evaluating a patient with a perianal abscess and you note a fistulous tract, how do you approach that patient as far as do you drain first, do you perform the fistulotomy, what kind of things are you initially looking for there?
Well, first of all, you got to raise the question. If you have 100 patients with a rectal abscess who show up in your clinic one day, what percentage of them, if drained, are going to end up with a resultant fistula and ano? And I remember when we wrote our first textbook, we really fought about this because there was conflicting data in the literature. And there was data out there that said it's 80%. There was data out there that said it was 60%. And we had the distinct feeling that it was less than this. Actually, there was data out there from John Gallagher in Leeds that it's 14%. Make a long story short, I think we put in the number 25 to 30% in our first textbook. And I really believe it's there, even though today you could read most textbooks and they quote a number like 50%. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we're giving the mock orals tomorrow to the fellows here at the university and at the Mayo Clinic. And if I ask that question, I'll bet you anything they'll come back with about 50%. Anyhow, going back, I just tell the patient you may end up with a fistula. Follow the abscess and see what nature is going to present for you. On the other hand, if they have a nasty abscess that you have to do in the operating room, and you're in the operating room and you drain the abscess and you can see the pus coming out of one of the crypts, and it's going to be an easy shot to put in a draining seton, then we would obviously use a draining seton. We've been great advocates of the draining seton. I really think that fistula surgery is going to be one of the most exciting things in the next few years because of the lift operation. And here there's a good story as well. I was in the operating room in Kuala Lumpur, and we were doing a low anterior resection. And this is in the year 2007. And one of the young registrars turned to me and says, "Dr. Goldberg, what do you think of the lift operation?" And my answer was, "What the hell is the lift operation?" I'd never heard of it. So then he starts quoting me this this article from the Thai Journal. And But the minute he described it to me, I said, oh, my God, that really makes a lot of sense. And actually, to his credit, Robin Phillips at St. Mark's Hospital had written an article back in 1993 about the lift operation. And I had read that article, and I thought it was I didn't think much of it. Anyhow, so I came home, and I thought about it, and I decided, you know, that makes sense. So we started doing the lift operation, and I think it's going to revolutionize exactly what's done for fistula surgery.
What kind of success rates are you seeing in your personal experience?
Well, we have published in the range of 60%. However, if you review the world literature now, it's creeping up there. And the world literature now, I think you can quote a patient that you have a 70-75% success rate with the first shot. I think a lot of the problems, if you analyze the whole world literature today, not everybody is doing the lift operation, what I call a classic lift operation. Not everybody is testing their closure at the first time, which makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. Not everybody is using draining setons and getting a good fibrous tract to work with. So that's why the data is different. And here, one of our former fellows, Dr. Morkin at Hennepin County, is putting together, and I think Dr. Steele might have something to do with this as well, study which I hope we can enlist quite a few people who are doing this operation and really collect some data that is significant. But I think you're going to see this operation will be the operation of choice, and we're going to stop cutting people's sphincters. We're going to stop using the cutting seton, which I think is barbaric.
So tell a little bit about, for the residents, we read about the different types of fistulas and how you have a high transpheric, low transpheric, and then a suprasphincteric and an extrasphincteric. Is there really an extrasphincteric fistula? How many suprasphincteric fistulas where it goes up and around and all that have you really seen? And what's your approach to these? Granted, there's complex fistulas, there's no question, but tell me your experience with these ones. They look good in textbooks, but in reality, give me your background on that.
Well, the extrasphincteric fistula, as you probably know, is probably related to malignancy, or it's related to an injury of the perineum. Somebody fell off fell out of a hayloft and got stuck with a pitchfork or something like that, and they end up with an extrasphincteric fistula. But I don't think I've ever seen an extrasphincteric fistula. High supralevator ones, if those are treated properly, they're really not very difficult. They've dissected up again up above the levator, and if you drain those back into the rectum, they'll just cool off, and you can handle them that way. But I think that they've been mistreated by surgeons over the years. Fortunately for the patients, the majority of complicated fistulas that you see are transsphincteric, low transsphincteric or high transsphincteric fistulas, and I think they can be managed beautifully with the lift operation after proper drainage and endorectal ultrasound. A lot of the studies aren't doing endorectal ultrasound routinely, and I think people have no idea what they're tagging into before they get in the OR.
Prior to the lift and doing fistulotomies, how much of the sphincter do you feel comfortable cutting? We read about a third and all that, but you know, who are the people you watch out for and would be a little bit more conservative with? And what is your comfort level?
First of all, Scott, whenever you ask that question, you've got to immediately clarify it. Are you talking posterior? Are you talking anterior? Are you talking lateral? Are you talking a female, a male? Are you talking somebody who's postpartum? All those play into the game. There's about three times as much sphincter muscle posteriorly. And so in a male, you've got a posterior transsphincteric fistula, which is a low transsphincteric fistula. You can probably get away very nicely with doing a fistulotomy in that individual. Cutting a similar amount of muscle in a woman who's had two or three vaginal deliveries, this could be a totally different picture. Mm-hmm. So, how much muscle? I think we should go for the lift operation and don't cut any muscle. That's where I come down today.
There's some of those different products, the different glues, plugs. Have you used those, or you found use of any of those?
Well, as you know, we've published on that, and as a matter of fact, the we started using the plug. I must say, when I first heard about it, it was very appealing. As you probably, if you read the data, you'll see that about they had an 80% success rate if it happened to be operated on in the state of Georgia. But when it got operated on in the state of Minnesota, the success rate dropped to about 40%. And if you look at the data around the world, personally, I think $850 for a plug is, when you can do a lift operation with a little Vicryl suture, it's going to cost $10. It's not going to cost $850.
Great, sir. Can you talk about some of your special considerations when operating on a patient with Crohn's disease that has a perianal fistula?
Well, this is the real bugaboo and the real problem. None of us has got, personally, I happen to be it all depends where the Crohn's disease is. I happen to believe that patients who've got only ileocolic Crohn's disease, oftentimes you can treat them just the same way as you can treat the individual who does not have Crohn's disease at all. However, if the patient's got rectal involvement or perianal involvement, just drain them. Do not try to do anything further. They about 14-15% of them are going to go on to have a proctectomy in the future anyway. So just drain those patients. You're not going to cure those. On the other hand, there's one abstract. I'm not sure, maybe he's published already. I think there's one abstract in the literature already from California where he's talking about a 60% success rate with the lift operation in patients with Crohn's disease of the anal rectum. That sounds pretty darn good, but I don't think we haven't seen that kind of results here.
Dr. Goldberg, before we switch to rectal prolapse, I want to ask you one more question regarding anal rectal disease. And I was wondering if you could tell the story very quickly about, we see a graft in the textbooks and we teach our residents all the time about, if a patient presents to you with a thrombosed external hemorrhoid, if it's within 72 hours, go ahead and remove that. But if it's beyond 72 hours and this dogma of 72 hours. So do you have any insight as to that graft and how that kind of concept came up?
that graft came out of a discussion that Phil Gordon and I had when we were writing the first textbook. And we debated it. And finally, we were sitting there kind of the back of the napkin. And we just kind of drew that graft. And then we asked our artist to make it look a little nicer. But seriously, it's true. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had a rectal problem or if you had an acute thrombosis hemorrhoid, and considering all the places in the world that you've been, Scott, and all the running that you've done, maybe you've had a similar problem. But if they really hurt, I really believe that you should overlap the pain period. If I can get rid of that clot and get rid of the and I realize the fact that you're going to have pain for 2-3 days, and by just taking care of that clot, the problem is that thrombosed external hemorrhoids are not handled very well by the average emergency room physician. Oftentimes, they'll just take a number 11 blade and take one clot out, which is superficial. What I teach and preach is the fact that if you're going to attack a thrombosed external hemorrhoid, take the whole hemorrhoid off and really do the job right at that time. But if the patient's not having much pain, it's already soft, then just tell them about the natural history and reassure them they don't have cancer and have them come back in a month or 6 weeks and scope them.
So when you're taking that hemorrhoid off in the thrombosed patient, is that in the operating room?
Well, very honestly, I've been blessed to work in my clinic. I've got a procto table that puts the patient in the prone position, and I have a superb assistant, and I can do it in my clinic in a matter of 30 seconds. I can take that thrombosed hemorrhoid right off, and I electrocoagulate. You got to make sure that the thrombosis doesn't extend up beyond inside the anal canal. But right in the clinic, you can handle that beautifully in the prone position. And this is one of the other problems about rectal surgery. As you travel the world, you see a lot of it. I was down in Australia, I think it was last year, and they were having a wet clinic, and they were going to talk about the lift operation, and they were trying to do the lift operation in the lithotomy position, and literally they couldn't see anything. And it would have been so simple if they had turned the patient prone where the assistant can actually help the operating surgeon.
And we're going to go into that a little bit in our tips and tricks segments later.
All right, so now we're going to switch to another very difficult problem, and that's rectal prolapse. So when a patient comes to your clinic, you know, oftentimes these are older patients with a lot of problems, and they're often very miserable. What's your kind of general approach, and how do you work up a patient who presents to you with a rectal prolapse?
Well, first of all, it hasn't been written about very much, but in our pelvic floor laboratory, we've been able to ascertain that a significant number of patients with rectal prolapse also have a non-relaxing pelvic floor. And when you look at recurrence rates associated with prolapse surgery, there's never been a study that I know of where they have documented, A, who gets a recurrence. Well, the recurrences oftentimes are related to the fact that these patients have a non-relaxing pelvic floor and they're straining their eyeballs out with every single bowel action. So in terms of etiology, if I see a patient with rectal prolapse and they are not a nursing home patient, I will study them. I will study them in our pelvic floor lab to see if they've got a non-relaxing pelvic floor, because then I can counsel that patient and say, look, you have a non-relaxing pelvic floor and your chances of recurrence are greater than somebody else who doesn't have that problem. So that's number one. Number two, it depends on the general health of the patient. Number three, if they're a nursing home patient and you get a call from a nursing home that they're pushing this rectal prolapse back every other night, I still believe that the perineal rectosigmoidectomy is a very good operation. It can be done on very elderly people. You can actually do it under local anesthesia with sedation or a regional block. And you actually can do the resection and the anastomosis all under direct vision. However, once again, not all rectosigmoidectomies are done the same. I happen to believe that you're dealing with a pelvic floor hernia, and I believe you've got to repair that pelvic floor hernia anteriorly once you've got the prolapse out of there and you're looking at the levators, and you've got to bring those levators together anteriorly. And so I think it's critical. And that's why a lot of the data on perineal rectosigmoidectomy varies around the world, because of the way they've been studied and the operation that's actually being done. They're not attacking the pelvic floor hernia. They're just amputating what's hanging out.
Yeah, what's your technique for that, for the levators?
Well, it's very simple. The trick there is to put a little retractor in anteriorly. And if you pull down, you're going to make those levators stand out, and you're going to have those two levators standing there, and you can just close them with two or three Vicryls, 0-2-0 Vicryls, and close the pelvic floor before you do your coloanal anastomosis. And the coloanal anastomosis, I think our leak rate was 1%,
yeah,
and over 200 or 300 of them that we've done.
Not many of us have a surgery named after us. And you obviously have the Frickman-Goldberg procedure, for those of you who maybe not as familiar with that. That is my residents better be. Kevin, what is that?
It's the rectopexy and sigmoid resection.
Okay, good. So we're all on the same page. Yeah. So how did that come about? How does one get an eponym named after them? And tell me along the lines of, when do you decide to use that particular procedure? Is that your mainstay? When do you decide not to do a resection? How does that go about?
Well, first of all, historically, I deserve no credit. I joined a fabulous surgeon by the name of Dr. Howard Frickman. And Howard Frickman was a very gifted surgeon. And his idea in those days, we were seeing a lot of patients who were coming to us with recurrent prolapses. And his philosophy and his idea was that if you could have a straight shot, anything that prevented an intussusception would prevent a recurrence. So if you took out the sigmoid colon and you prevented the patient from having a intussusception, then you could prevent recurrence. And this was based on the studies that came out of Sweden. Make a long story short, he had collected these cases. I joined him in the practice. And the next thing I know, he wrote this article and he put my name on the article, and that's how it's there. I had nothing to do with it.
So how do you decide when to do that one versus rectopexy alone or do the perineal approach?
in answer to your question, I got to be honest with you, we rarely do a resection today unless the patient has a markedly redundant colon or they've got obvious significant sigmoid diverticular disease. Rarely do we do that. The operation that the surgeons today are going to have to deal with is the ventral rectopexy. Mm-hmm. The Europeans and the Australians are writing about this, that it's God's gift to rectal prolapse. Well, as you probably know, everybody's concerned about the mesh that they're using. And so people in the United States are afraid to put in a permanent mesh, and so they're putting in biologics. And then the biologics dissolve, and then what happens? If you'll notice, there have been very few, if any, reports of long-term results on the ventral rectopexy. You might know about some, Scott, that I don't know about here in this country. Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything coming out of this country?
Not off the top of my head.
Same here. I haven't read any that I know about. And all the results are coming out of Europe, and the majority of those patients are being done with a permanent mesh. And so how you can take an operation, and if you think about that operation, they're actually closing the pelvic floor hernia. Now, none of those studies that I've read, have they really studied the patients, whether they've got a hidden, whether they have a non-relaxing pelvic floor. So in answer to your question, I think that you're going to see it's an operation that's going to go through the evolution. I think that's the key.
What do you do with those patients that recur? How do you handle that?
It all depends what the first operation was. As Dr. Steele will tell you, he reviewed our results with rectosigmoidectomy, and I would go ahead and do a second rectosigmoidectomy. I mean, if I got an elderly patient and for some reason it recurred, the morbidity and mortality associated with a recurrent rectosigmoidectomy, I'd go for it again. The trick is, what do you do if somebody's had a, quote, anterior resection and you've got an anastomosis in the rectum and now they got a recurrence? This gets a little tricky because you don't know what the blood supply is going to be to that mid portion of the rectum if you do them from below. That's pretty tricky, and because you could do a rectosigmoidectomy and all of a sudden end up with a dead piece of bowel that you're looking at. Mm-hmm.
Sir, how do you handle internal intussusception?
Internal intussusception, I think you've got to educate the patients. Very honestly, if you look at some of the data coming out of Australia, they are operating on these people. They're doing ventral rectopexies on these people. And a lot of their series are really quite large, and they're claiming excellent results. I don't know if I would, I think I would just instruct these patients, and I would, I'm not sure I'd be quick to operate on them because I think the results are going to fade with time.
Have you seen at Minnesota that biofeedback helps in those patients?
Yes, definitely. We have a superb, thank you for bringing that up. We have a superb clinician, a woman. She is just outstanding working with those people so that they can improve.
Well, sir, we're going to transition now into our segment, Tips and Tricks. These are our helpful hints by our experts to get us out of those sticky situations. And today we're going to focus upon something, not necessarily a technical trip, but something that is probably most important of anything we do, and that's setting ourselves up for success. And so I would love if you'd talk to us about how you position your patients for anal rectal surgery, some tips and tricks to help us get better exposure into anal canal. How do you teach the fellows and the residents that work with you to be able to say, anal rectal case or a pelvic dissection in these patients, this is what you go about it?
Well, actually, I take my hat off to Professor Holm from Karolinska. He is teaching the world now how to do an abdominal perineal in the prone position. As you undoubtedly know, Scott, we have done it that way here at Minnesota for the last 50 years. And Dr. Frickman, I'll never forget the day that I was taught to do it in lithotomy position, and I thought it was a bloodbath. And then I'll never forget the first day I operated with Dr. Frickman. We mobilized the rectum down to a certain stage, made our stoma, closed the abdomen, and we flipped the patient. We went out, we emptied our bladder, we came back in, and we were able to do the perineal portion. I just couldn't believe the difference. And from that day on, I was always in the prone position. The tricks are simple. You just have to have a roll underneath the patient's hips, and you got to be able to usually to slip your hand underneath the patient's abdomen, and then you tip it down. But the beauty of the prone position, your assistant has got a headlamp, you got a headlamp, and you both can see, your assistant can see what you're doing, your assistant can help you, and it really works beautifully. In terms of the mobilization of the rectum, all you have to do is just go through the anococcygeal ligament. I happen to disagree with Professor Torbjörn Holm from Sweden at the Karolinska. He says that you have to take off the coccyx routinely when you're doing an APR. And I think you're adding an element of pain and discomfort for the patient. It's a rare rectal tumor that you have to take off the coccyx to get it out. So I would just go at the tip of the coccyx and go through the anococcygeal ligament. Next thing you know, you got your finger around the levators, and you take each one of the levators, and the rectal stump just pops out. And the anterior dissection is all done under direct observation. And it just seems like a very logical way. And as I say, I take my hat off to him teaching people how to do that. In terms of anal rectal surgery, there's just no question that the prone position is far better than the lateral sims. It's better than the and your assistant can help you. Your assistant can see what you're doing. And in terms of anesthetics, if you augment with local anesthesia, you can do them with an LMA if you want to put a tube in, or you can use spinal, caudal, whatever you like.
How do you do your anorectal block?
Well, I happen to believe I don't specifically go in to try to hit the nerves specifically. Some people go directly for the nerves in the posterior aspect, right posterior, left posterior aspect. I just infiltrate the skin and then infiltrate the muscle, and I will start with lidocaine, which is quick acting, and then once I've got my block in with lidocaine, then I will redo the block with Marcaine so that the patient has got a long-acting anesthetic following an anal rectal procedure. But we used to keep our anal rectal cases in the hospital for 5 days. And when I know you're laughing, but that's exactly what was done. And now they're not in the hospital, but 5 hours.
And do you have a preference for your retractors that you use for a hemorrhoidectomy or for fistula? Or what anal rectal retractors do you like?
Well, when I started traveling internationally, and they always wanted you to operate, so what I learned is if I took my Pratt bivalve, I could just about do every single operation. And what taught me a lesson was, I remember I was in New Zealand, and they had never seen a closed hemorrhoidectomy because they had all been raised on an open hemorrhoidectomy. And so I said, sure, I'd be happy to do that. So then I went down and I talked to the head nurse, the head sister, at the hospital. I said, may I see your rectal instruments? They didn't have any. So make a long story short, I had to end up doing my first closed hemorrhoidectomy in New Zealand utilizing a vaginal speculum. And that was a little tricky. But anyhow, it worked out. They could see the benefits of a closed technique. Even today, the closed hemorrhoidectomy is not performed. The most common hemorrhoidectomy still in the world today is the amputative Milligan-Morgan operation that St. Mark's is advocated. Here in Minnesota now, as you may or may not know, we have a fair number of Somalis. We have, 100,000 Somalis who have immigrated to this area. And we're seeing all kinds of complications, anal rectal complications related to the surgery that they have had over in Somalia. And a lot of it, I'm sure, was related to open hemorrhoidectomies because they're coming in scarred and strictured. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you saw that as well, Scott, when you were in Afghanistan.
Not as much.
That does it for our tips and tricks segment. The next thing we do, sir, is we have 5 questions. They're lighthearted, fun questions we ask every guest we've had on. The first one is, if I were to open your song library in iTunes, if I were to look at your iPod, what would be the most played, and what's your favorite?
Well, as you probably know, I enjoy classical music. So it would probably be one of the Beethoven symphonies or one of Mozart's piano concertos.
Do you play music in the operating room?
No. There's another story there. I was called as an expert witness because, and I won't tell you where this was, I was called as an expert witness on a case where the pathologist had called into the surgeon and said that the biopsy, that it was a adenoma, a villous adenoma. The surgeon misunderstood, because there was music being played, the surgeon misunderstood what the pathologist said and interpreted as saying carcinoma and took the guy's rectum out for a benign villous tumor of the rectum. And so in my operating room, no music whatsoever.
Wow.
Great. Sir, can you tell us a hidden talent or special interest you have outside of the operating room?
Oh, not much.
Go no, for basketball?
I didn't do very well at basketball. I was lucky to make the tennis team in high school. No, I'm not an athlete like Scott. But I do follow sports, and I used to teach swimming. I paid my way through med school teaching swimming, which was fun. And now, fortunately, we have a cottage out on a lake, and so I can still mess around out there.
I think one of your talents is probably your lovely wife, who is incredible in her own right.
You guys don't have enough time to listen to me expound about that fabulous woman. I mean, what she does, both nationally and internationally and locally, she is unbelievable. Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Dutch government even named a tulip after Luella. I don't know if you know that, but if you ever go to the Netherlands and you go to the Keukenhof Gardens, you can see it. The Dutch government was so impressed with what she did that they named a tulip after her.
Number three, this might be hard for you. You've been around the world time and time again. What's the most memorable vacation or trip that you've ever gone on?
I'd really have to say the first one. When Luella and I had the opportunity, here we were, two young kids. We just had our first baby. We got on the SS France and went over to St. Mark's Hospital and landed there. I mean, believe it or not, there was still rubble in London from the war when we arrived. And I mean, we pinched ourselves that here. And when we left London, we had made some very good friends, and we thought we'll never see these people again. I would say that probably it was the first time out of the country. Other places, my first trip to Japan. I remember I was so impressed with the food, the presentation of the food. I took my camera out. I was taking pictures of what they were feeding me. I was so impressed. And it was fun operating in Japan. Nobody in the operating room understood English. And I remember operating and pointing at various instruments. And let me think, what other places? Sri Lanka, New Zealand. The New Zealand is, if you ever get an opportunity, go to the South Island, New Zealand. It's absolutely gorgeous.
So if you didn't become a surgeon, what else would you be doing? What other career path would you have chosen?
Oh, actually, I think Scott knows this. I actually came to medical school thinking about, because I used to run a camp when I was in pre-med, I thought I'd be a pediatrician. However, during my internship, I was exposed to trauma, and then I thought I'd be an orthopedic surgeon. And then I hadn't been in the service yet, and so I signed up for a general surgical residency thinking that I better know how to take out somebody's appendix if I'm out at sea someplace. And that's how I got started into surgery, and I ended up on colon and rectal surgery.
Sir, if you could go back to the first day of your internship and give yourself one piece of advice, what a piece of advice would you give yourself?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you learn from your residents. Actually, I was fortunate. I had in my group that we rotated, there were three interns that rotated together. I had a phenomenal young man with me. His name was Rod England. Actually, he was an AOA graduate out of the University of Illinois. I learned more from Rod because he had a lot of experience. Our experience at Minnesota may have been heavy on the books in terms of practical experience. We hadn't had much, but Rod had spent a certain amount of time at Cook County, and he was a great mentor for me during my internship.
Well, Dr. Goldberg, we'd just like to thank you for joining us here at Behind the Knife. It's been a fascinating experience. I love the stories and love a little bit about the history, about the specialty, and about the things that you've seen across the world and learned from not only them, but the people who you have trained. And we cannot thank you enough, and we look forward to having you back on Behind the Knife.
All right, that's it for us today. Thanks for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Goldberg and sharing with us his insights on rectal prolapse and anal fistulas.
We really appreciate you guys being here with us. If you guys can go out on iTunes and give us a review, it'll help bump us up the charts. Follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife. You'll get the latest details of who we have coming on the show. And also hit up our Facebook at Behind the Knife and our website at www.behindtheknife.org.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fascia's closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast.